Okay, the intrepid explorers go down to investigate the alien life form. They've cut it in. Okay. Who does this kind of stuff? Yeah.
It's interesting how it comes right. It's right at.
Yeah.
Put it right at the human crack.
Yeah. It's just wild. Huh.
We gotta see if there's any writing on it. What the heck is that?
This is In the Hive. I'm Roger McDonough. Just over a week ago, the Utah Department of Public Safety released footage and images of this thing in the San Juan County desert. Wildlife biologists were out counting bighorn sheep using a DPS helicopter. A glint of metal caught the eye of one of the crew members, and it's basically impossible that you don't already know the outline of this story. Monolith, obelisk, stela, whatever you want to call it. The footage, you were just hearing from it, went up online, and almost immediately it became a worldwide phenomenon. Truly an overnight sensation. What was it? How long had it been there? Just who put it there, and why? It looked familiar. Some people immediately connected it to Stanley Kubrick's film 2001, A Space Odyssey, based on the sci-fi bestseller by Arthur C. Clarke. In the film, an otherworldly object appears in the desert landscape where human ancestors, apes, encounter it. It's a kind of extraterrestrial intervention in human cognitive evolution. The Utah Department of Public Safety wouldn't say where they'd found it, just that it was very remote. They were worried about people trying to visit it and getting injured or stranded. There were also worries about the damage that hordes of people trampling through the desert to see the thing could do. But mysteries are meant to be solved, and the internet went into overdrive. Teams of people put themselves to the task of finding the object, not by trekking across the desert, but by scouring public and online records. Quickly, almost too quickly, on the discussion website Reddit, one person with a username I can't say on the radio because it breaks some FCC rules. Anyway, he figured out exactly where it was.
Yeah, so late Monday night on Reddit, I started seeing a couple different subreddits that a lot of people were looking for this thing. Someone brought up that the Utah DPS, Utah Department of Public Safety, only actually had one or two helicopters registered to them, and they were able to actually post the tail numbers. I spent a lot of time on flight trackers just because it's kind of interesting. They're all free websites that monitor air traffic. And a couple of those, if you put in the tail number, it'll actually show you the flight history of the aircraft. So that really narrowed me down to a certain area of where I was looking within, I'd say, maybe 50 linear miles of helicopter track of where I kind of needed to look.
That's Tim Slane, who again has a Reddit handle that I can't say on public radio. Tim's in Colorado, by the way, but never even had to leave his house in his search for the object. As you heard, he got the flight data for the helicopter, he tracked where it went, and then he opened up a satellite view of that flight path and went to work looking.
So the next step was just kind of zeroing in on the photos that the actual crew took. Utah DPS crew posted a bunch of photos of the monolith. They posted video of kind of the looking down into the canyon.
Who does this kind of stuff?
So I started just kind of looking at basic facts from that. I started looking at rock color. I started looking at the erosion patterns in the rock. I started looking at the canyon floor, the amount of vegetation around it.
It's just wild.
And I mean, sound like a PI, I'm not, but yeah, I just started looking at just really, really basic elements of the video. And I started getting on Google Earth, kind of looking around saying, what lines up with this criteria? So finding, you know, a triangle pillar a foot and a half wide in the middle of the desert, that's going to be next to impossible. What I was hoping was to find the shadow of it, which is what I did finally locate into. Through the video those guys shot, I was able to figure out that the canyon faced south, so I knew it'd have direct sun onto the pillar and would be casting a long shadow. And luckily, the satellite image was taken in, I think the one I was using was in November, so that does put the sun lower on the horizon. During that time, I was kind of looking, trying to figure out when it was installed, and the downloadable program, Google Earth Pro, actually has historical image overlays. So you're looking at their most recent, but you can click and go back through time. So I was able to line up images from 2016, 2015, and looking at the 2015 image, there was no shadow, and it didn't look to be anything sitting in that canyon. There is actually some vegetation there. So whoever installed it might have pulled up some plants as well or destroyed them doing it. I'm not really sure. But yeah, that was basically how I figured out the time frame of it. It's kind of impressive that it's been out there for 4 to 5 years and no one found it until a week and a half ago. So I did sit on the information for maybe 45 minutes, maybe an hour, kind of late at night on Reddit, and I was debating whether to release it or not, because I knew once people knew about it, people were going to go out to it.
Tim thought about not disclosing the location of the monolith, but in the end decided that he would release that information because, well, we'll let him explain.
Yeah, I'm posting it now, but if I don't, someone else is going to do it in 3 hours. So, it's like, well, why not just save, you know, all these other hundreds of people who are now looking for it? Why not just save them the time and just tell them where it is?
Again, that's Tim Slain, who made the location of the monolith, or obelisk, the object found out in the Utah desert, public. And quite a few people did a sort of pilgrimage to the spot after Tim made that location public. Not as many as certainly would have liked to have. We'll come back to that. But there was, of course, a great deal of speculation about who put this thing out there. You've probably even got your own theory. At first, the joke was that it was aliens. Others thought NASA, or a GPS hunt by a conceptual artist. The New York Times, in an article, suggested the minimalist sculptor John McCracken. One of my first thoughts, and a view that a number of friends shared, was that it was a Utah artist and desert wanderer by the name of Adam Bateman. Some of you will know that name. Bateman ran Quack, a gallery and art space that was here in Salt Lake City, and that before that was in Ephraim. It used to be called the Central Utah Art Center. Anyway, Adam is a sculptor, and he's also obsessed with the desert. And, well, putting two and two together, it just seemed to fit. Adam was also totally dodging the direct questions people on Facebook were asking him about whether he did this. So, last week, before this story had reached its full crescendo, I called him up to see what he had to say. The first time that I actually learned about this was when a friend from England sent me a link and said, hey, do you know who did this? And I racked my brain and a few suspects came to mind, including my dad, I have to admit, who does pranks of this sort. A couple of friends also came to mind. And then I talked to one of those friends, Austin, and he said, oh, it's totally Adam Bateman who did this. He's the likely suspect. And then more than a couple of people who I've spoken to since that time have suggested you as a potential, you know, they've speculated that it was you who did this. So the question I'm going to ask is, do you have any confessions to make here, Adam? Anything you want to say on that front?
I don't have any confessions.
All right. And that's as good as we're going to get from you.
I wanted to kind of respond to the way you found out about it. The way I found out about this, this discovery is I was in the backcountry in the desert for 7 days with no reception, doing a project with some friends that was related to my art practice. And when I turned on my phone, I had over 100 text messages from all over the world asking if it was me. And I didn't even know what they meant for the first several text messages. I'm like, what do you mean? What was me? Like, you know, so that's how I found out the news broke. And clearly lots of people thought it was me or think it's me or something.
I pressed Adam for a bit on whether or not he was the author of this deed. but he remained firmly as cryptic as you're hearing there. So instead, recognizing a dead end when I see it, I asked for his thoughts on what it was, who might have made it, how it might have been installed, and, well, why. There's been speculation since then. I mean, like, there's a New York Times piece out just recently that suggests, I guess, that this is the minimalist artist, John McCracken. Any thoughts on that front, Adam?
Yeah, I mean, I saw the tweet by David Zwirner, his gallerist, that originated that theory. And David Zwirner said something to the extent of, I personally think it's John, but the gallery is really divided on this. And so it was no official statement by the gallery. So first of all, I mean,
McCracken died a few years back, we should say.
Right. But his estate or a studio hasn't said anything, you know what I mean? And of course the gallery hasn't made any official statement. It's just this like sort of flippant comment by David Zwirner. Second of all, I mean, John McCracken doesn't have any sort of like monopoly on monoliths. There's some specific things that make me think that this isn't, that from an objective perspective, I would question whether this is John McCracken. I mean, first of all, the rivets have been brought up a lot, and the sort of level of craftsmanship and the level of expertise and technical attention, especially coming from a minimalist artist, they never show the screws, they never show the rivets. That would be very C-minus work by a guy like John McCracken, especially being a minimalist. I mean, here's a guy that makes mirror polished, no flaw anywhere minimalist objects, and then this is this thing with rivets in the desert that isn't that. It does have a level of craftsmanship that surpasses a lot of like student work, which complicates it too.
How do you, like, if you were going to do something like this, and again, I mean, you talked about the flippant comment from the gallerist, but on Facebook, I saw you say, you know, my official comment is no comment. But if you were going to do something like this, you know, what would it require? It's pretty remote. Like, what would this take?
Well, I mean, it's remote and it's not remote, right? It's like maybe a 1 to 2 mile hike from the nearest dirt road. And the rivets are there because it makes it easily assemblable from parts without like welders and things like that.
Like three panels basically put together. Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah,
exactly. Mm-hmm. And then people who know about construction, most sculptors or construction workers could think through the factors of say, okay, like we go out and scout about round, find an appropriate place that feels really remote, but is like relatively accessible. Get a team of two or three people to pack these things in, rivet them together. You've got the tools. These days, a number of brands of tools make battery operated, all sorts of stuff that can cut stone or like whatever. If you bring a few batteries, you pack that stuff in a backpack, you get in there, do it at night, and you get out, I suppose.
The artist Adam Bateman merely supposes that's how it might have been done, because again, he's not saying whether or not he was the one who did it. But so, was this done by a professional, local, or even world-renowned artist? That's not a view held by Felicia Baca, director of the Salt Lake City Arts Council.
You know, having worked in the field of public art for some time and art history, my read on it is that this work is a little bit amateur in nature. I, as you mentioned, I'm sure that Adam was a very likely suspect for a lot of people. I don't actually have specific suspects in mind, but of course I've been reading about the different theories and the ideas of who created it. And I think what comes to mind for me is either some sort of, you know, Maurizio Catalan trickster of the art world, sort of artist that could potentially be an amateur, or, you know, there's the theory that it potentially could have been created by students. And what I find so fascinating is that, you know, this type of artwork is not new. The minimalist, shiny sort of, you know, we refer to this affectionately sometimes as plop art. And in context of art history, it can be interesting, but the other thing that we see happen a lot in the art world is replication, right? And this also kind of conjures these feelings for me of issues of forgery and the value that we place upon art. I mean, it's entirely possible that students or an amateur, somebody that's not even an artist, could derive an idea like this and situate it somewhere. And, what's interesting is that when you have something that's devoid of authorship, I think, interestingly, the public just felt like they could take it, right? There's no authorship ascribed to the object.
In my conversations with both Felicia Baca from the Salt Lake City Arts Council and with the artist Adam Bateman, something that kept coming up was whether this object was deserving of preservation. Did it hold enough significance for it to be protected by the Bureau of Land Management as basically a cultural resource? Cultural heritage is something that BLM is dedicated to preserving. But generally, in that context, we're talking about older items of historic significance. Anyway, it was an interesting discussion, but as I'm sure you already know, it's kind of a moot point. Here's Amber Denton Johnson, manager of the BLM's Monticello Field Office, explaining why it's a moot point.
I actually went out on Saturday to take a look at it. I'd gone previously on, Tuesday last week and followed what was going on, went out on Saturday afternoon, and it was gone. In fact, somebody said to me, the BLM took it down. I said, well, I'm the BLM field manager and I didn't take it down, so I'm not sure where it is. So
there are some hints as to who took it down. On Facebook, a photographer said that he was there on Friday evening taking photos when four people came up, pushed on the monolith, and knocked it down. The photographer, Ross Bernards from Somerville, Massachusetts, said that one of the four guys said, "This is why you don't leave trash in the desert," and that another of them, as they wheelbarrowed the pieces away, turned back to them and said, "Leave no trace," a phrase used to promote conservation ethics in the wilderness. It's not the ethic that was being followed by many of the people making a pilgrimage to the site.
So what we saw over the course of this last week was, as the interest grew, more and more people came, more and more people ended up there at the same time. We saw sort of a de facto parking lot develop over time where, technically it's not illegal to pull over on BLM lands and park on the side of the road. But in this case, we had, on Saturday, there were at least 50 cars over a fairly small location, all parked off on the vegetation. It's a long way out there, 2.5 hours or so from Monticello over a long, really bumpy road. It's hard to hold it that long, there was toilet paper on the side of the road in various locations, those are the types of impacts that we saw. And it was really, I think, a result of everything coming so quickly and the interest growing so fast, so fast.
Still, despite those impacts, Amber Denton Johnson says that before it was removed, the BLM was pondering whether or how to preserve the object.
We actually, when we went out to the site the first time, we actually brought our cultural resource specialist with us. And you're right, this is not the type of cultural resource that we would generally consider in this area. And the state SHPO came out with a statement and said it should not be compared with the types of cultural resources that are really common in this area. But there really was this larger sort of cultural phenomenon that I think you were getting at. We had people all over the world that were interested in it. And so where we were in this last week is in an active investigation, trying to figure out where it came from, what its significance is, who placed it there, what it's doing there, and then how we're going to manage it going forward.
That echoes something Adam Bateman told me, which was, look, this thing already has become massively culturally important.
If we had discovered this 100 years in the future, how would that change it? Because then it's this historical thing. I mean, all these kinds of questions are really, really complicated. And I think that they go back to that point about this being a culturally significant object independent of who made it. And because of the life it has in the world right now. And
Yeah. And object versus the artist, right?
And like, I think it's an interesting question, because I think that honestly, in today's way of evaluating art, we're going to look at the author, so to speak, or the artist, and we're going to say, you know, is this a college student? If so, it's just littering. Is this John McCracken, this famous artist? Well, no, then we've got to preserve it, because this is like on par with the Spiral Jetty. Or what if it's Adam Bateman, this guy that's like, you know, done a lot of stuff in Utah, but is not super famous in the rest of the world, but like, whatever, you know, he's not John McCracken and he's not a student. Like, I don't know. How do you do that kind of calculus? It's too hard for my brain.
What about the fear of copycats, you know, going and quote unquote littering the desert with their own monoliths or their own, you know, troll dolls? Or,
well, I mean, we got to start with Walter de Maria, Robert Smithson, Michael Heiser, etc. These guys 50 years ago went in a bit, and some of them are still working on things. James Turrell and Michael Heiser is still working on some of their projects up there in the desert. These are things that are celebrated because they're famous artists and like whatever. And no one asked the question, is that going to inspire? Clearly, they inspired more people to do this kind of thing. A. And B, I mean, you take a guy like Andy Goldsworthy, who is like the most loved and hated artist in the freaking world. Hated by artists because it's too pretty and loved by everybody else. and his work is all ethereal and like whatever, but it's still man's intervention in nature. And what does ethereal mean? Does it have to disappear in 3 minutes to be okay? Or what about 30 minutes? Or what about 30 years? Or what about 300 or 3 million years? I mean, if we're talking about geologic time, in several million years, we'll be lucky to find many traces at all of humans on this earth, right? Mm. So maybe even like, the very question about littering the desert is anthropocentric.
Well, I do think it depends on who's interacting with it. I mean, the thing that's been so cool about this is we have all kinds of people chiming in. We have like archaeologists and public lands people and journalists and filmmakers and you know, all kinds of different intersectional people chiming in, and we can't even agree on the nomenclature of, is it a monolith, is it a sculpture, is it even art or not?
What comes next is, you know, I'll just give the example. You know, I was out there on Saturday and it was crazy busy. There were so many people, dozens and dozens of cars. And got out Saturday night. I had a couple of park rangers flagging down cars to let them know it wasn't there. So we didn't end up with more passenger cars out on this four-wheel drive road. Really, by about 2 o'clock, everyone had gone, you know, and today there's nobody out there, you know, maybe a few people that were there already. And, but it really has quickly gone away once the interest was gone. And we are going to be looking at reclamation work right away.
We haven't talked about Kubrick here, and there's obviously, you know, that moment in 2001, Space Odyssey, is sort of like the inspiration for tool use among, you know, the predecessors of humankind, when the object is discovered by these sort of chimpanzee-looking pre-humans. I mean, what are your thoughts on the Kubrick connection here?
Well, I think it's awesome. It clearly seems like a reference to Kubrick, but I think there's also some interesting problems with it. So first of all, in the Arthur Clarke novels that Kubrick based his movie on, the monoliths, there are multiple monoliths in those novels, they are actually computers. And they are computers set down by a super advanced civilization that were set on Earth and in other places in the solar system and in the universe to actually inspire and facilitate the rise of technology and the advancement of the civilization.
Why do you think people went as crazy over this thing as they did?
who knows, people are crazy, you know. I think it's really, it was a time that a lot of people were looking for an interesting story. And so I don't know what motivated people. It's a hard thing to answer. I'm not going to really speculate on it too much, but it did really truly capture the imagination of a lot of people. And we heard from folks all over the spectrum as to what they thought we should do with it, what they thought it meant, whether it was art, whether it wasn't, you know. So I think there's just, like people, there's a wide variety of opinions and ideas out there.
You know, honestly, I was telling a friend about this. I think if it was 2018, nobody would have cared. But I think it's the 2020, what else could happen this year? I think that kind of influenced the popularity of it. And, you know, it's kind of like, you know, everyone's hanging around wondering what could go wrong next this year. And it's like, okay, aliens put a pillar in the desert. You know, that was the first thing. So I think that's kind of why it became such a big deal. I really think if this had happened on another year, it probably wouldn't be that big of a deal.
At the beginning of the show, I mentioned the fact that the obelisk in Stanley Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey has been interpreted as sort of a extraterrestrial intervention in human cognitive evolution. Well, maybe the monolith that appeared in the Utah desert became the overnight phenomenon it became because people thought of all the years humanity could use an intervention, 2020 might just be the one. But the monolith, its work complete, seems to have climbed back into that mysterious realm from whence it came. Or, I guess, got torn to pieces by some desert wilderness defenders.
I love that it's gone. I actually, just for the story to come full circle, is very humorous to me. I love speculating. I mean, I've seen all sorts of pictures of people at the site, and I love thinking about who were the people or who was encouraged to transport this thing out of there. So I actually love that, you know, sometimes the process is the work of art, right? And or the product. And in this case, I think that's it.
That's it for In the Hive here on KCPW, a listener-supported, entirely independent local public radio resource. Find podcasts wherever you get your podcasts or at kcpw.org. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.